Genesis 25 and 26. Abraham took another wife, whose name was Keturah. She bore him Zimran, and Jokshan, and Medan, and Midian, and Ishbak, and Shua. Jokshan became the father of Sheba and Dedan. And the sons of Dedan were Ashurim, Letzershim, and Lemumim. The sons of Midian were Ephah, and Epher, and Hanoch, and Abida, and Eldaah. All these were the sons of Keturah. Now Abraham gave all that he had to Yitzhak. But to the sons of his concubines, Abraham gave gifts while he was still living, and sent them away from his son Yitzhak eastward, to the land of the east. These are all the years of Abraham's life that he lived, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last and died in a ripe old age, an old man and satisfied with life. He was gathered to his people. Then his sons, Yitzhak and Ishmael, buried him in the cave of Machpelah in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar the Hittite, facing Mamre, the field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth. Were there Abraham was buried with Sarah his wife. It came about after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Yitzhak, and Yitzhak lived by Be'er Lahai Roy. Now, these are the records of the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maid, bore to Abraham. These are the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names in the order of their birth. Nebaioth, the firstborn of Ishmael, and Kedar, and Adbael, and Mibsam, and Mishma, and Duma, and Massa, Hadad, and Tama, Yetur, Naphish, and Kedma. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names, by their villages and by their camps, 12 princes according to their tribes. These are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years, and he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. They settled from Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt, as one goes toward Assyria. He settled in defiance of all his relatives. Now these are the records of the generations of Yitzhak, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Yitzhak, and Yitzhak was 40 years old when he took Rivkah and the daughter of Betuel, the Amraman, and Padan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. Yitzhak prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren, and the Lord answered him, and Rivkah's wife conceived. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is so, why am I this way?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from your body. The one people shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red, all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. Afterward, his brother came forth with his hand holding on Esau's heel. So his name was called Yaakov. And Yitzhak was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter and a man of the field. But Yaakov was a peaceful man living in tents. Now Yitzhak loved Esau because he had a taste for game. But Rivkah loved Yaakov. When Yaakov cooked stew, Esau came in from the field, and he was famished. And Esau said to Yaakov, "Please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished." Therefore, his name was called Edom. But Yaakov said, "First, sell me your birthright." Esau said, "Behold, I am about to die. So of what use then is the birthright to me?" And Yaakov said, "First, swear to me." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Yaakov. Then Yaakov gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went on his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Chapter 26. Now there was a famine in the land besides the previous famine that had occurred in the days of Abraham. So Yitzhak went to Gerar to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines. And the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Stay in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and bless you. For to you and to your descendants I will give all these lands. And I will establish the oath which I swore to your father Abraham. I will multiply your descendants as the stars of heaven, and I will give your descendants all these lands. And by your descendants all the nations of the earth shall be blessed. Because Abraham obeyed me and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." So Yitzhak lived in Gerar. Then the men of this place asked about his wife. He said, "She is my sister," for he was afraid to say, "my wife," thinking, "The men of this place might kill me on account of Rivkah, for she is beautiful." It came about, when he had been there for a long time, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out and through a window and saw, and behold, Yitzhak was caressing his wife Rivkah. Then Abimelech called Yitzhak and said, "Behold, certainly she is your wife. How then did you say, 'She is my sister'?" And Yitzhak told him, "Because I said, 'I might die on account of her.'" Abimelech said, "What is this you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have been brought guilt upon us." So Abimelech charged all the people, saying, "He who touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." Now Yitzhak sowed in that land and reaped in the same year a hundredfold, and the Lord blessed him. And the man became rich and continued to grow richer until he had become very wealthy. For he had possessions of flocks and herds and a great household, so that the Philistines envied him. Now all the wells which his father's servants had dug in the days of Abraham his father, the Philistines stopped up by filling them up with earth. Then Abimelech said to Yitzhak, "Go away from us, for you are too powerful for us." And Yitzhak departed from there and camped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. Then Yitzhak dug again the wells of water which had been dug in the days of his father Abraham, for the Philistines had stopped them up after the death of Abraham. And he gave them the same names which his father had given them. But when Yitzhak's servants dug in the valley and found there a well of flowing water, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with the herdsmen of Yitzhak, saying, "The water is ours." So he named the well Esek, because they contended with him. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over it too. So he named it Sitna. He moved away from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it. So he named it Rehoboth, for he said, "At last the Lord has made room for us, and we will be fruitful in the land." Then he went up from there to Beersheba. The Lord appeared to him the same night and said, "I am the God of your father Abraham. Do not fear, I am with you. I will bless you and multiply your descendants for the sake of my servant Abraham." So he built up an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Yitzhak's servants dug a well. Then Abimelech came to him from Gerar with his advisor Ahuzat and Phicol, the commander of the army. Yitzhak said to them, "Why have you come to me, since you hate me and have sent me away from you?" They said, We see plainly that the Lord has been with you. So we said, let there now be an oath between us, even between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you, that you will do us no harm. Just as we have not touched you and have done to you nothing but good and have sent you away in peace, you are now the blessed of the Lord. Then he made them a feast, and they ate and drank. In the morning they rose early and exchanged oaths. Then Yitzhak sent them away, and they departed from him in peace. Now it came about on the same day, when Yitzhak's servants came in and told him about the well which they had dug, and they said to him, we have found water. So he called it Sheba. Therefore, the name of this city is Beersheba to this day. When Esau was 40 years old, he married Yudit, and the daughter of Beri the Hittite, and Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. And they brought grief to Yitzhak and Rivka.
I'm running these two chapters together because there's a reason I have a purpose here. But what do you think so far you read? What is it you come in your mind? What's some of the questions or what are your comments before we start?
Isaac did the same thing Abraham did to his wife. She's my sister.
Yes.
And just the stories between Isaac and Abraham are abnormally similar, almost strikingly similar. That seems odd.
Yes. Seems odd. No doubt about it. Kind of like he followed in his father's footsteps on the thing, right? Pretty darn close to it, but not completely. Yes?
I'm curious, historically, what those children that Abraham had, that he sent away, is there any way of... Do they have anything to do with all the Muslims that are out there right now?
Not the Muslims per se, okay? But yes, it does have an awful lot to do with them. He sent them eastward. In other words, he sent them over the river, past Euphrates River. So we have an awful lot. And there are many of the Indians believe they are descendants of Abraham, the big huge nation of India.
Yeah. If I recall correctly, the term Havalia is a territorial land, which I discovered a couple of weeks ago regarding it's a land of wasteland or a desert area. It's also a title of a city that is east of where Abraham was, or a town or region. And it basically just sent him to Havali, which is recorded in Genesis as well, a land full of gold, but of nothing else.
Nothing else, yes. Pretty barren land. All right. So let's begin here. I know there's an awful lot of who is Keturah, she remarried again. Her name is a very interesting name. That's just a sidelight here. It means that which is perfumed. In other words, she was able to make perfume and use incense to have smoke. Her name came to be known later on, where you put the Bible, where the incense was at the tabernacles. That's the same word, same kind of name, meaning between. It's just a fascinating note when I read that, and I said, that's kind of interesting. So what she did, she burnt incense, and probably, Abraham continued on doing his, probably, I would assume, it doesn't say there, an offering or something he gave unto God, and he probably had her burn incense in the same method. It's just got an interesting story about her. But I'm going to drop down now to verse 7. And these are the days and the years of Abraham's life, which was, that he lived, 135, or 175 years. That's quite a long time, right? But remember, who was still alive? Shem was still alive. Way back then. All right. The great-great-grandfather. Maybe it's the fourth great grandfather. I can't remember how far back that goes. I got my notes at home, but not here. So, and I'm going to do this again because I do this for a reason. And the reason why I'm doing this is because we live in a world that does not believe much of anything in the Bible. How many years from the flood was this when he died? Okay. Remember, it's 367 years when the flood, when he actually left his father's house. How old was he? 75 years old. Now we have he dies at 175 years. So that puts it at, what, 467 years from the time of the flood. And the reason why I'm counting the time of the flood is because it gives us a beginning point. It gives us a point where we could start from. We always use this A.D. and B.C., and sometimes that really gets confusion. And so I'm going to look at it from the time of the flood onward. It's a little bit easier to keep record when you have a given date in the Bible, precisely the date, that gives us an idea of where we start from. Because the old world was done away with, in a sense. And the new world began with eight people. Remember? In the beginning. We're going to go through all these names because they're not necessary. I mean, there are an awful lot of names, by the way. There's a couple of names that you'll know. Midian is one of them. Remember, who is he? He was Jethro. Jethro? Who Jethro was? Remember? All right. Okay, yes. He was the priest of Midian. Oh, Midian, by the way, means for strife or in quarreling or in hostility. But that doesn't really mean one thing or another, but just this is what the name means. And we're going to drop down to verse 22. Genesis 20, chapter 25, verse 22. This is probably one of the most well-known areas for those who are familiar with the Bible about. Now, Rebecca had a problem. What kind of problem do you think she had? A what? Barren, all right. But verse 22, we're past that. She had a problem. What was her problem? She tells her what the problem was. What was it? Fighting in the womb. Let me tell you, that's unusual. All right, babies fighting in the womb, struggling in the womb. Yes?
Actually, it's not unusual for twins to fight in the womb.
Well, this particular one, very fascinating one. It's the first one recorded. We had to find out why. All right? And that word struggle, I know some of your translations have struggle. What do some of the other translations have? The word struggle? Go with most of you see? All right. Well, that's the word struggle is a very unusual word to be translated in English. It's more closely related to the word oppression. One was being oppressed by the other inside of the womb. And that pressure, oppression, putting pressure upon one and the other. She felt that pressure. And she wanted to know what was going on inside of her. And so it has to do with something being crushed, something being damaged. She could have lost the children, basically. And that's what she went to God and found out what it was. And God spoke to her. In verse 23, very fascinating. We all kind of know what it means, right? I think it's very fascinating to look at this thing. Because Hebrew, it's a little bit different wording. And it says, And Yahuwah said unto her, two nations in thy womb, and two manners of people. What this in Hebrew means, there are two gatherings of people inside of your womb. Two gatherings of people. Very interesting phrase because that's going to come up. And of course, interesting here, is one of the gathering of the people will be stronger than the other gathering of the people. Very unusual phrase to you, right? But that's not the end of it. Because most of the translations, including this one, says, and the elder shall serve or work for the younger. That's not exactly what it says in Hebrew. What the word, the one that says, the elder, that elder means the one that is greater, has more, is more bountiful, has numerous, more than the other one. So the one that says the elder, or he's not referring to an age, that the gathering of the peoples, one of the gatherings of the peoples will be bigger, larger, more massive in number than the other one, which is says younger, means a less unimportant one or the one that's insignificant.
Hebrew verb is abad, which is in the Strong's 5647, and when we see the phrase to work, we see almost something that implies something voluntary.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
But this is not. It talks about slave, burden.
Beating, honor, burden, that's right.
This kind of thing. Imposed, bondage,
yeah,
and so on.
That's right. Thank you for bringing that one out. I did look that one up. I didn't bother writing down my notes, though. All right. And the younger one means, you know, a little bit less significant, not as big. So you have one gathering of peoples, which is a much bigger one, is going to have more than the other one who has less of the gatherings of people. So we have two families here. One of them will be very large and powerful. And the other one will not be as large and powerful. Okay? But it says here, now, the one that is less than will have power or authority over, and they will become the multitude of the larger one will become the slaves or the servants thereof of the younger one. Now, so it's a prophetic thing that's going to happen pretty, well, not pretty soon, but in the history of mankind. And, of course, you know, Esau's name is what? Harry. Hi, Harry. Harry one. The red-haired one. Got a funny name. But now Jacob has a different name. It basically means what it says. Heel holder. But remember, he was hanging on to the heel of Esau. And what took place there? Now, I know people have said, which I cannot prove it by Scripture, because the midwives were looking at there and they saw what took place, and they're the ones that gave the name to the younger one and called him Jacob, the heel grabber. Now, we know they were fighting in the womb, right? Or they were, one was being oppressed by the other, the greater one being oppressed by the lesser one. And so there was a talk that he reached out, he had his hand, reached out and grabbed his heel because he was in the womb, was kicking him in the head. That's just a belief system or a thought system. It doesn't make any difference. But one thing about Rebecca, I don't think it was an easy birth. Probably one of the most difficult births that a woman probably has ever had. Fighting during the pregnancy and fighting all the way until he came out of her. She probably was really happy when it was all over with, you know. Of course, we know that one she loved more than the other, and Esau was loved by Isaac more than the other. Now, at this point in time, the birth of Jacob, and Esau was 60 years old, right? And Abraham was still alive at this point, although we have read he has passed and died away. But Abraham was 160 at this time. Jacob was 16 years old when Abraham died. So we have these 160 years, and that's why you have some of the scriptures in the book of, I can't remember where it's probably in Hebrews, where he lived, Abraham lived in the camp with Isaac and Jacob. So in Abraham's old age, he began to live where Isaac had moved to and where Jacob was at the same time, living in the campsite. Right? And, you know, he read about verse 29 about Esau came in the field, and he was, this translation says that he was fainted. that's a really unusual word, means to be exactly what it means. He is down, lost. He is weary. He's going to, in a sense, a point of death. He was at the point of death. He's at the point of dying. All right? Remember, these two brothers are fighting all the time, right? In the womb, they're still fighting. Now the upper one is now at the hands of the younger one. In realistic life, the greater one became subservient to the younger one. And this is just a picture of one of the scenes that took place. And we have it here where, of course, he was wanting some soup. Of course, it was red lentil soup, so that's why he got renamed Edom, meaning the red man. Okay. And he said, "Now, what's the value of that birthright?" Verse 33. This is one of the questions I do not have an answer to, and I'd love to have the answer. Because here Jacob says, "This day I would like, swear this day." I'd like to know what day that was. Be interesting to find out if that has anything to relationship to anything, and in connection to one of the three seasons. It'd be fascinating to know that. We won't know that, but it'd be kind of cool if we ever had that answer. Now, in all the translations, including the translations that most all your translations, it says there, the very last verse, "Thus Esau despised," and it says, "his birthright." That's not what it says in Hebrew. He despised the birthright. It wasn't his anymore, right? Now it belonged to his brother. Now, when you talk about despising, what does that mean? Regard it as worthless. Regard it as there's no value to you. All right? So he really wasn't interested from that point on about the promise that was given to Abraham or his father, Isaac. He didn't care. He despised it. He hated it. And he didn't want nothing to do with it. So he actually moved, When he got older, he moved away to the other side of town, almost to the side of the river. Yes?
He's brought up to a prideful person that won't receive, Christ or whatever, a self-willed person.
To a degree, yes, but Esau has to do with something far deeper in the future that's going to be taking place. Okay. It has something to do with what he despised. Okay? Has something quite powerful with that, and he is always on the case and always wants to be on the case, but he never will ever win. That's what he will not do. Now, next chapter. Any question in that chapter?
Another question is, it's a spiritual thing. I mean, Esau did not have any kind of regard for spiritual matters.
Doesn't say that.
No.
Don't assume that. Mm. Don't add things that are not in the Hebrew. Don't add things up. Don't. You might have heard that from people, but that's not what it says. All right? Be careful when you address these things and assuming that he was not a man who really liked God, despised God, and hated God. No, he hated the birthright. Despised that part. Okay, I'll be very cautious with this. Yes?
Well, you'll probably go over this in the next chapter because that's when it's mentioned, but it mentions a couple of things that makes me think that she may have a point insofar as, number one, he married two women and neither of them were of the family that...
Right.
Abraham had gotten Isaac's wife from.
I understand that one.
And so and those women were presumably pagan, what we would call pagan, worshiping idols or maybe not knowing God. So I think in that sense, that's an example of him despising the spiritual aspect of his birthright if he would marry these kind of women, wouldn't it?
It's possible. The only thing I had to backtrack on this, we're coming under an assumption here. It's like with Abimelech under Abraham. We had an assumption that Abimelech was a pagan. But that's not what Abimelech said. He said unto and used the name of God himself. So they knew who God was. And we have to kind of keep this in our mind. The Hittites knew who God was. And when Abraham bought the piece of property from a Hittite, they knew who God was. The paganology came to a grudge much later. It was more in the eastern part in Mesopotamia area under Nimrod. All right, go from, I don't want to go back under Nimrod, but this influence of what's happening where they're at, we had to be careful not assuming that everybody was pagan except Abraham and Isaac. Yes.
Well, one of the things that the Apostle Paul brings out in chapter 1 of Romans is that people can know exactly who God is and just don't care.
Right. That's very strong.
I just wonder if is there a biblical a gospel application to the concept of birthright, and like we're born again, we now have a birthright to the kingdom of heaven. Is that stretching this? I was just wondering. The douche would make a big deal of the birthright here.
I never thought about that line. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's good point to think about. Did Daniel hit something?
Well, in my personal opinion, a birthright for the birthright that Esau and Jacob were quarreling over, it's a property-based issue, but it's also a promise-based issue. The promise, the birthright that was transferred down was birthright of God. It was essentially that God's ownership would be you and you would be his back and forth. And so, one could argue that in a gospel concept, well, Messiah is the birthright, we are to account it very valuable as to what he did. And any one of us who had it, meaning believed in him, and then thus rejected it, is the same principle that Esau went through by
yes.
then making his rejection. It's taking the Messiah's life and what he did as being of no value to you. So one could easily argue that. Whether that's exactly what was happening here, hard to say, but you could argue that.
All right, the first chapter 21, 26, rather. And there was a famine in the land. Okay. When you go to, let's go to Genesis, the 12th chapter for a moment. I want you to try to put yourself in a different scenario, if altogether possible. Because we are in this 21st century, we believe that famine is a natural occurrence that occurs on a regular basis on a cyclical period of time. It has always been that way since the creation was made. But that's not what the Word of God says. The first famine that ever struck was during Abraham's life, when he first moved into the land of Canaan. Now, we think, because, see, we look at the Middle East today, we believe with all of our being, because we see with our eyes, there's always been a desolate place. Nobody lives there. And we look at northern Africa and look at the Sahara Desert, we say, it's always been there since the creation. Nobody lives there. But that's not how it once was. Because even the Roman Empire, what did they do? They had wheat. They had corn. They were growing their foods in that northern part of Africa. Now, we have here, we're here in the 10th chapter, 12th chapter here, where God sends down Abraham, as I want you to go someplace, and he goes. And the first thing that he encounters is a drought or a famine. And now that was a test. Test on Abraham. What did Abraham do when it came? You remember? He went down to Egypt. All right. So you have a test. We know what took place in Egypt, right? He should not have gone down there. Things were not got worse for him. Okay? And that was in the chapter 12, beginning in verse 10. Is now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to sojourn there, for the famine was severe in the land. Now, here in Genesis chapter 26, guess what? There's another famine. It's besides the first one that was in the days of Abraham. So now we have a second one coming. Now we assume because, quote, Mother Nature, in a quote, brings about famines. Yes.
Jeff and I were just talking here a second ago. It's climate shift. Great flood.
Great
lots
flood.
And lots of water. All that water evaporates. It's going to permanently change how global weather happens. Everything will be shifted. Everything will alter and be weird now.
And weird, right. But we have this thing, and now the same thing happened here during time of Isaac. And guess what he did? He left. Of course, he didn't go all the way down to Egypt because God said, don't go down there. But he did went to the land of Philistines, or the land of Amaleks. And he went there. What was his problem when he went? What kind of problem did Isaac have moving there? Huh? Fear, okay. All right. Listen. Verse 18. And Isaac dug again the wells of water. Verse 19. Dug in the valley of a well, and the servants, and there he found a water, a spring. 21. And they dug another well. 22. And he dug another well. Verse 25, dug another well. Then they go down to verse 32, dug another well. What do you think he did for a living? This is the one man that had to do more digging for wells. His men had to do more digging for wells than probably anybody else you see recorded in the Bible. It's kind of comical, all right? But when you look at now, what did the, after Abraham died, what did the Philistines do? They fill all of Abraham's wells and cover them with dirt. Why?
You're afraid of it, right? God's
promise to I'm sorry, what?
That doesn't make sense why you would close up a water producing well.
No, it doesn't, but they did. What was their purpose?
If I recall correctly, during Abraham's time, wasn't there an agreement between the Philistine, whatever his name was, and Abraham that the peoples for all generations would not quarrel about property, in this case was the well. So they couldn't take the well, because that would be violating their own laws,
right.
But they could fill it up.
Only one well they couldn't take. The rest of the wells they took. It's a well of Beersheba. Or not, yeah, Beersheba. Anyway, we have this thing that Isaac was full of doing the repairing of the wells and digging the wells all over again and renamed each one of those wells. So all these wells that we see listed here or be named off, Abraham dug them first, or his men, he dug them first. Now, they needed this. Why were they doing this to Isaac, though? They had to wait for Abraham to be dead. Isaac tells him why. What do you say? You hate me. That's why you're doing this. He never went to war. He had more men. He had more power. Had more influence. Had more money. Had more of everything. But he never went to war. What didn't Abraham did go to war, right? But Isaac did not go to war. So he dug a well, verse 18 here. He dug a well again, the waters of the well, which they had dug in the days of Abraham his father, for the Philistines had stopped them up, and after death Abraham. Now, the object wasn't Abraham. The object was they wanted to stop Esau. Isaac. They despised him. They hated him. Why? Because he's gotten richer and and richer, more and more money. It's a typical, hate the rich man. Hate the wealthy one. Hate the one that has more than anybody else. Let's evenly distribute his wealth amongst us. We can't. Let's cover up. Let's cover up his source of wealth. Cover up all the wells. Well, you know, God still blessed him. He kept opening up those wells. Now, he didn't. When he dug a well, there's a couple of them here. This is the very first well they dug was, well, not the first well, one of the wells, verse 20. And he says he dug a well, and named that well Eskeek. Why? That word means there was strife. He let the Philistines have it. All right? You take that well. He dug it. They said it was theirs. Didn't want to fight. Didn't want to quarrel. And he dug another one. And it's also it's called Sinah, meaning the one that opposes your opposition is striving against you. So he says, okay, you got that one. He left. And they were hating him, wanting to get out of there, wanting to kick him out of there. And so he moved from there and dug another well. And no, that one, they didn't. And he named it Rehoboth. And just means simplicity. And he says why he called it that. It means a wide space, a lot of room. Because now he moved there, he had enough to house all of his men. And all his servants, and all his cattle, all his herd, and anything else that he happened to have—a lot of goods. So the area was—he called that was a wild. That well was called a wide place. The wide place. And of course, he dug more wells in there, and he got more and more water. And then, of course, Abimelech came. All right. Let me ask you, who is a liar here? Okay. And then it went to him from Gur, that's where Abraham once was, and Ahusath, one of his friends, and Phicolah, the chief captain of his army. And Isaac said unto them, why for you come? Seeing that you hate me, you sent me away. And he said, well, we saw certainly that Yahuwah was with you. And we said, let there be now an oath betwixt you and betwixt us and thee, and let us make a covenant with thee, that thou wilt do no harm, as we have not touched thee, and we have not done thee nothing but good. Well, really? What about all them wells that just got through digging down there, covering them all up? What about those other two wells just striped with, ready to go to war with? And he left. Didn't do him any wrong? Someone's a liar here, isn't it? We didn't do any hurt you. We didn't bother you. Yeah, right. Like, same argument that Abraham, remember the story of Abraham there, that Abimelech, that different king, but had the same quarrel. And he said, well, I don't have done you any harm. Uh-huh, yeah, right. And you read the story of the dove, back, first one stabbed in the back. Very interesting, huh? All right? All right, now. So, just that being said, we have more, and he finally made this deal. So he made a feast, verse 30, and they did eat, and they did drink. And so they made another one, they rose up in the morning, and they swore, and went on their way, did what they're supposed to do. And now, when they left, then came to pass the same day, that they had a feast, that Abram's servants came and told him concerning the well which they had dug. They were digging another well. Boy, he's got a lot of wells, doesn't he? You know, got to feed all them cattle. You got to have water for it, you know. And he called it Sheba. What does that word mean? All right. More specifically, has to do with the number 7, right? Every time you see the word swear or swore in your English translation, it's the Hebrew word for the number 7, all right? What does the number 7 mean? means complete. Every time that word seven shows up, it means complete. So he called the place complete. It was actually seven. It was. Now we get to have the word Bereshiva, or Bereshiva, the well of seven, or the well of the oath, or the well of the end. Now the agreement's been done. Can't change the agreement. An oath has been made, and that's it. So it's very interesting. The word seven is so well used in the Bible so many times in so many different places that we don't really know what it means. So they throw in a word, or they just don't throw in a word at all. They just use the Hebrew word. Not knowing exactly what it means, it does have to do with the word seven. Like Shavuot. Shavuot. Sevens, plurality, means a completion. Something's coming to an end, and it's completed. It's finished. Now, Esau was 40 years old when he took his wife, Judith, and so on and so forth, and it grieved the minds of both Isaac and Rebekah. How old was Isaac when this took place? He was 100 years old. When Esau was 40, how old was Isaac? He was 100. Now, there's some ages I want you to pay attention to here because I think it's very, very fascinating. I pay attention to ages and see if there's a parallel. I go by ages because ages are a very fascinating thing to me. And I want to find out. I got some more notes here. Hold on. Backtrack here. Okay. We already talked about how many years it was, and it was 170 years from the flood that Abraham died. How old was Isaac when Abraham died? He was 75. He was 75 years old. Kind of parallels with Abraham at 75 years old. He had to do something with God. Now Isaac, 75 years old, now has to follow. And when Abraham was 100 years old, Isaac was born. And now, with him, at 100 years old, his son did something that grieved him. Married the wrong person. A trial. 100 years, 75 and 75. We haven't reached Isaac's death yet. But it's kind of interesting to put these parallel words together. There's something happening paralleling these names and their ages. And certain the Bible records their age for a reason. Not just because it's convenient, but tells us a story of something that's going to happen or did happen, and it's going to be let us know in the future. Now, with that being said, how do you feel? It was 492 years from the flood. The very last thing is that when Esau married these other people, it was 490 years from the flood. How distant is that in their mind? Shem was still alive. No, he died this period. He died between that. No. But you got 490 years. And the reason why I'm going to keep hammering on the thing about the flood is because in our world, the flood has no bearing on our lives. However, it still has a bearing and will continue on having a bearing all the way until the end. The devastation in that flood devastated the face of the earth so much that it was never going to have its face again until He begins to restore. I want to go back here now to the book of Revelations. I want you to understand something that I think is very fascinating. Because when Revelations, the book of Genesis opened up, and it says the pane, the face of the earth, was covered with water. You remember that? The pane. And then after the flood, the earth really lost its face. All right? Didn't look like it looked before. And Revelations is a very, now I think Jewish, if for the man who wrote this was a Jew. I'm sorry, what? Well, that's a technicality of a word. We'll not get into that. What actually, what it says that came up from in the second chapter there in Revelations, I mean in Genesis, it says that there was no plants, no nothing, and he let water come up out of the ground. Then he made man. A moisture came up out of the ground, and he made Adam. Now, Adam's made out of dirt. And that's where that phrase comes from there. What people believe, that there was no rain at all, is an assumption, but I can't prove one way or the other. I didn't know the very first part there, the second chapter of Genesis, when the water came up from the earth, that's when God used it to create man. Okay, so he came out of the flesh. He came out of the water. The only thing you could hold the man together with was water. Mud can't, you have to use water in order for mud to stay. But the earth was already covered with water long before. Lots of it, because the second chapter, first in the second day, he said he separated the land from the waters, which is separated from it. Now, what we have in our mind, we picture something that we, since we're not there, we're trying to guess that it was like this and was like that. Scientists are trying to prove that it was different type of atmosphere. And they went through some studies. Every time they tried to go to the study, prove that there really was no rain, they couldn't come up with evidence. The place was getting too hot. If it had that cover over it, like they think it had over it, nothing would be alive. It would be over 500-600 degrees on the face of the earth. Yes?
Question. When you said the word revelation before, you meant Genesis?
No, I want Revelations. I was telling you. Told you in Revelations tells you something. And first, I told you, Genesis talked about the earth, the face of the earth, right? All right. After the flood, the face of the earth changed. Didn't look like once was.
Could this be also that when the earth came out of the waters, that it was the earth was coming out from the darkness into the light, as you know, man coming from the darkness into the light, made into the likeness of God after the flood. Out of waters.
You could look at it from that point of view. I'd have to think about that a little bit longer. But okay. Right now, in chapter 20 of Revelations, all right, you got to think on the Hebrew word of pane. All right? And I'll use an example. But it says here, verse 11, I saw a great white throne, and him who sat upon it, and from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was not found any place for them. What do you think that's talking about? It's the face of the earth and the face of the heaven that we have in a roundabout atmosphere that tried to turn its face away from the judgment, and it couldn't. What tells you the very next verse? What did the earth have to do? It couldn't not turn its face away. It had to face the Creator. What did the earth have to do? Had to give up the dead. Had to give up those that were in the sea, those that were in Hades, and those that were dead. Earth could not turn away. So the face of the earth had to be looked at and had to have judgment put against it. And the earth up came. And then it says in verse chapter 1, 21, I saw a new heaven, a new earth, for the first heaven or earth had passed away. The face of the heaven and the face of the earth passed away, and it got restored from its very beginning and the restoration of everything. I told you that God loves this earth. And he says, I will destroy anyone who destroys this earth. That pretty well tells you what he thinks, don't you? Why would he say that for? Why would he say that I will destroy anybody who destroys this earth?
Of the creation,
Yeah, it's great. It's great. It's his. Don't destroy what belongs to him. And if you do, you're going to be in trouble. So our face will change. Our appearance will change. Everything will change, including the restoration of it as it once was. Yes?
But the face of the earth, he's treating it as if it's a living, object. Or
what did Apostle Paul say about the earth? Is all creation moans and groans, waiting for the sonship of God to come and take over. The sonship of God are going to be participating in reshaping the face of the earth. Everything that's been created is waiting and moaning and groaning for the sons of God to take over. I believe that. Now, maybe you think a different theory on it. But I'm just telling you what Apostle Paul says, and I believe that very strongly. So there's going to be, and they're in the book of Isaiah, and I think it's in Isaiah anyway, where that the sons of God, or so the ones who come back to reestablish this earth, they are going to reshape everything. They're going to reshape towns, reshape buildings, they're going to reshape the life as it once and should be. That's the function of, that's what you are being trained for now in this world. That you will be one of those who will be reshaping, reforming, restoring back from the very beginning, verse 1 of chapter 1 of Genesis. Verse 1, chapter 1, that's the restoration where everything's going to go back to where it once was. And we are to be part of it. All right? So a lot of things will change, will shape, and will alter. And it'll be done by not the power of man's scientific brain, because the scientific brain of man is worthless.
You're saying that the earth is going to be the same as it is now, it's going to be reshaped, the buildings and
reform,
all of that?
Reform, yeah. Because once the destruction has come, once he has destroyed it, it's going to have to be rebuilt.
But the Bible says that that God is going to destroy the earth with fire.
Correct. Now,
everything that man has made is going
to
be destroyed.
He's not going to burn the earth up, but he's going to burn what man has made up on the earth.
Yeah.
He could burn the face of the earth up. What you and I have put together. Yes, as human beings.
So the buildings and all of this stuff is going to be gone.
Correct. But we will rebuild. Mm. We will restore.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
As God wants it from the very beginning of creation, when he began to create man in the first place. You know what I'm saying? A lot of things that man messed up with in the very beginning. They should have been doing what God wanted to do in the first place, but they didn't.
I thought you were saying that, you know, the things that...
Oh, no. No. Okay.
I was just reading this yet today. It says on Revelation 2, verse 26, "To him who overcomes and does my will to the end, I will give authority over the nations. He will rule them with an iron scepter. He will dash them to pieces like pottery, just as I received authority from my Father. I will also give him the morning star. He who has an ear to hear, let him hear."
Yes. Yeah.
That's
what's going to happen. You know, and we are to be part of that. I'm a person that really looks at a concrete things. I'll use that terminology. I'm going to change that word in the future. But what God has created in the physical world is real. It's not artificial. It's not phony. It's real. Every animal is real. Every plant is real. You can touch it. You can feel it. You and I are real. We can touch it, feel it. By the way, iron is real. You can touch it, you can feel it. Rocks are real. You can touch it, you can feel it. Those are real. They're concrete. You can depend upon them. This is why it says that when you land your feet upon the rock, he's talking concreteness. And a spiritual realm, that means that the Messiah is the rock. He is not artificial. He is concrete. He is solid. And we can depend upon that. That's why they use the rock so many times and explaining about the rock, meaning that Yahshua is the rock. You could depend upon that. It's just as real as a real rock.